They bled us white, the bastards. They taken everything we had. And not just from us, from our fathers, and from our fathers' fathers.
And from our fathers' fathers' fathers.
Yeah.
And from our fathers' 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 fathers.
You're right, Stan, don't labour the point. And what have they ever given us in return?
The aqueduct.
What?
The aqueduct.
Oh, yeah, they did give us that. That's true, yeah.
And the sanitation.
Oh, yeah, the sanitation, Reg. Remember what the city used to be like?
Yeah, all right, I'll grant you, the aqueduct and sanitation are two things the Romans had done.
And the roads.
Well, yeah, obviously the roads. I mean, the roads go without saying, don't they? But apart from the sanitation, the aqueduct and the roads...
Irrigation. Medicine.
Education. Yeah, all right, fair enough.
And the wine.
Yeah, that's something we've really missed, Reg, if the Romans left.
Public baths.
And it's safe to walk in the streets at night now, Reg.
Yeah, they certainly know how to keep order. Let's face it, the only ones who could in a place like this.
All right, but apart from the sanitation, the medicine, education, wine, public order, irrigation, roads, a fresh water system and public health, what have the Romans ever done for us?
Brought peace.
Oh, peace! Shut up!
Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is a pleasure to have Dr. E. Michael Jones back on the show. Dr. Jones returns to discuss an article he recently wrote regarding the passing of Queen Elizabeth II, Requiem for a Figurehead. Of course, Dr. Jones is the editor of Culture Wars magazine, the author of many books, including The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History, and the most recent book, The Dangers of Beauty, The Conflict Between Mimesis and Concupiscence in the Fine Arts. Dr. Jones, how are you doing this evening?
Good, Tim. Good to be here.
Well, thank you for coming back on the show. Before we get into the main topic, I'd like to get your take on this political stunt that Ron DeSantis has pulled off. Apparently, he decided to enrich the fine folk, liberal folks of Martha's Vineyard with some 50, mostly illegal aliens from Venezuela. They flew them in, and they were there for about, I guess, a day, less than a day. And then they were unceremoniously removed by the National Guard. Over 300, I think, troops were mobilized to remove 50 of these enrichers.
Yeah, the best headline I saw was Mi casa es su casa.
Well, they explained this can't handle it. They're not Brownsville, Texas, or El Paso.
That's right. I know they're. We figured that one out already. Oh, no. It's Martha's Vineyard. I know. Look, how many people could fit on Obama's estate? You know, I mean, that's a lot. That's a big estate.
Well, as it was explained to me, Martha's Vineyard is a small island with a lot of big houses. They don't have the resources there. I think Obama's estate is 29 acres.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you could fit a lot of people there. You know, homeless people, tents.
So I guess public services it pays you well, because the Obamas, I don't think they've.
I don't know how you earn. The house costs like $14 million. What does he earn as president?
I think it was $400,000. But he didn't have to pay rent.
$400,000. That's right. So he could save a lot of money. Yeah.
Well, I guess 8 years in office, he probably could have gotten a good down payment on that if he just banked it all.
That's right. But there may be other sources of money that he's not telling us about.
There might be, actually, yeah.
Like the Clintons. They have their Clinton Foundation, and you had to pay them significant speaking fees.
That's right.
Way out of proportion to the quality of the speech. But actually, the best take I saw on what happened on Martha's Vineyard was Ken Burns. Ken Burns is the famous documentary maker. became famous when he did that documentary on the Civil War. He said that sending immigrants to Martha's Vineyard is like Hitler rounding up Jews and putting them in Auschwitz. Now, I never thought of that. I never thought of that.
There are pools at Martha's Vineyard.
Maybe he's talking about the swimming pool at Auschwitz or the orchestra. Maybe that's what he's trying to tell us. But then the stormtroopers showed up and they actually did round them up.
Yes.
They rounded up these people and they did put them in a concentration camp. But it's the other side that did that. DeSantis just let them have free run of Martha's Vineyard where they could go to the beach and go swimming and who knows?
I heard people saying this was a terrible exploitation. It was cruel. It was pure evil. I was like, wait a second. He's giving them a free trip to Martha's Vineyard.
I had a free trip to Martha's Vineyard.
I think the weather's still nice up there, isn't it?
I just got back from the Jersey Shore. It was beautiful. I mean, September is the best time to be there, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, unless there's a hurricane, but that didn't happen this year. But he's talking this way because he just did a video on the United States and the Holocaust.
Oh, that's right. That's coming out later this month, isn't it?
It's already out. It's the first segment already played.
Oh, is this where he blames the United States for Holocaust? This is what I call Jewish gratitude, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We're all a bunch of anti-Semites because you don't let that ship full of Jews land here. I think that's what the gist of this thing is. And a lot of, as he has gave Debbie Lipstadt a lot of time to talk. But unfortunately, these guys, they're all playing checkers when the rest of the world is playing chess. They can't think two moves ahead. So the Holocaust narrative came into being after World War II. It was a collaborative effort because people like Eisenhower were guilty of war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically the Rheinwiesenlager, and they needed a way to distract the world's attention from the war crimes that they had committed. And so they created the Holocaust narrative. It was basically two filmmakers. Billy Wilder did the American film, and Alfred Hitchcock did the British film. But the point of the Holocaust narrative is it's the founding myth of the American Empire. Because the American Empire is a benevolent operation because we all risked our lives to save the Jews from the Nazis. That's the whole point of the Holocaust narrative. Well, now you're shitting in your own nest here.
Mm-hmm.
Because now you're declaring that the Americans were bad people. You're going to wreck the narrative when you do this. You always take it one, you always turn the thing one, turn the screw one turn too far and you strip the threads. And that's what they did. That's what they're doing in this. And they're too stupid to even know what they're doing.
Yeah. I guess World War II veterans now, but close to 100 or past 100 and most are dead now. So maybe they feel safe doing that. And it is a certain amount of irony here that to the extent that World War II is understood as a crusade, is seen, a lot of that is based on the narrative of World War II, particularly Nazi tyranny and the Holocaust.
Right.
Now they're destroying that narrative. Yeah.
Yeah, it happened very quickly. As soon as Eisenhower came into the Ohrdruf, nobody even knows about it anymore. It was down the road from Buchenwald, which became famous. But he came in. And he saw the dead bodies lying on the ground. Well, that's indisputable. There were dead bodies mm-hmm. lying all over the place. And he said, this is important because the American soldier doesn't know what he's fighting for. He needs to know what he's fighting for. So this was the moment where Eisenhower declared the meaning of World War II. It was basically to prevent, things like this ever happening again, these dead bodies showing up. And of course, the dead bodies are a category of reality. They were there. They were certainly there. But what he did was impose the category of the mind on them. And that took a little bit of time before that sorted itself out. So it eventually became the gas chamber. But before that, so right down the road from Ohrdruf was Buchenwald. And So he prepared this in advance. He sent two psychological warfare operatives in before anyone else, and they created a display. And then Patton got the mayor of Weimar to march 2,000 people, citizens of Weimar, out to the camp where they had to witness this display. Well, the display was C.D. Jackson, who was working under General McClure in psychological warfare. He was the most famous psychological warfare guy in the 20th century. He went on to become Eisenhower's campaign manager, got him elected president. Eisenhower appointed him head of psychological operations for his administration. He was then became basically Harry Luce's right-hand man mm-hmm. for Time magazine, which was the propaganda ministry for the United States of America at that point.
Didn't he sequester the Zapruder film?
Zapruder film. He ended up owning the Zapruder film.
Yeah.
So he puts this exhibit on the table. It's a lampshade that's supposedly made out of human skin, which is not. It wasn't a pelvis, an ashtray made out of a human pelvis, which is kind of a stupid idea because it's full of holes and the ashes would go all over the place. And then two shrunken heads. And this was to show what the Nazis were capable of doing. This. Well, this is preposterous. The Nazis are shrinking heads. This who knew? They got them from some museum. So it was a colossal blunder. And then it went down the memory hole. Even they tried to enter this. I think they were successful in entering this as evidence in the Nuremberg war crimes trials. But even there, it turns out that it was, you know, it's not that lampshade was not made of human skin. And it became an embarrassment and it went down the memory hole, but not before Billy Wilder photographs this whole thing. And it's up on the internet. You can watch it on the internet. So it then became, Elie Wiesel then said that it was flaming pits. And he said, I saw it with my own eyes. Or was it a dream? This he constantly used as this trope in his book Night, but then he said he saw Nazi soldiers throwing Jewish babies into flaming pits. Well, that went down the drain because the United States Air Force was doing reconnaissance films of Auschwitz, and there's no evidence that they had anything. So finally, at this point, this was primarily in collaboration with the Soviets because they were the ones who took over Auschwitz. And they came up with the story of the gas chamber.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's funny, this comes up anytime there's an issue, whether it's the trucker protest in Canada.
Right.
Or Ron DeSantis, who by all accounts is a proud Zionist. So
yeah, right.
Does him no favors to pander, does it?
No.
They don't get anything. They equate it to Hitler. I saw that on MSNBC, the Jewish interlocutor brings it up with Ken Burns, and he's there to agree with him. And I was like, what has nothing to do, whatever. It's reduction at Hitler.
It does have a little bit to do with Hitler, but it's the exact opposite. When the stormtroopers came in and rounded up the immigrants and put them in a concentration camp, that sounds like Hitler. Yes. But Ron DeSantis didn't do that. The Democrats did that.
Then they accuse him of human trafficking, of all things, despite the fact that the Biden administration has been, I think, illegally shipping thousands of illegal aliens throughout the country, dispersing them. And sort of this whole thing is sort of an electoral strategy to brown the country, as they say. You know, this unrelenting stream, these are Biden's words, by the way, of non-white immigrants diluting the white the native white population. Of course, this is a violation of Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution, which commands, it says, the federal government shall protect the states, the individual states, from invasion. And of course, an invasion doesn't have to be an armed force of a foreign country. It can be a horde of immigrants there to disrupt, because we all know migration is often weaponized.
It certainly is.
So yes. This is an invasion, and they are in derelict of their duty. This is treason. But then again, you can't shame commas like Alejandro Mayorkas or Merrick Garland to do their duty.
No.
To the Constitution, because their duty isn't to the Constitution in their mind.
No, it's their duty to their ideological group of people, and both of them are Jews.
Yeah.
And so you have this Jewish animus against the majority population, which is characteristic of Jewish thought, wherever they are. They always hate the majority of any country that brings them in. They always feel that there are all latent anti-Semites out there, and we have to be very vigilant and completely unaware that their obnoxious behavior is the main cause of anti-Semitism. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. That's the problem here and now. And it's this weaponization of race, the weaponization of migration, which they did. They subjected Europe to this, took advantage of the Christian, the remnant of Christian feeling in places like Germany, and we have to be good to the alien and so on. It's completely mm-hmm. exploited that in a completely weaponized fashion. And now the reaction is setting in. I don't know whether you heard, but Swedish Democrats yes. just drove that other coalition out of power in Sweden. And this is anti-migration, an anti-migration party. The same thing is going to happen in Italy, according to every poll that I've been reading, where Giorgia Meloni mm-hmm. is going to be elected. And she is an Italian nationalist. So it's the dialectic, it's the cunning of reason. The internationalists, the Jewish internationalists, overplay their hand, and then suddenly the reaction comes, and then they don't know what to do. They're upset. So it's not only is it Ken Burns who's doing a Holocaust documentary, Wolf Blitzer is doing one too. So you know, if Wolf Blitzer and Ken Burns are both upset, it must be really bad.
A lot of new things can be said about the so-called Holocaust, right? If they really want to, like they talk about Holocaust education, I really want to talk about education. There's a lot of questions that can be asked, but they want indoctrination. But it's funny, they keep bringing this up again because they sense a reaction and they want to intimidate anyone from saying anything. And this is what this whole, the White House recently had a United We Stand conference and Joe Biden, I guess, was the last speaker, but they had all these so-called experts, Susan Rice there, Merrick Garland was there, Alejandro Mayorkas was there. They all, basically, it was a bashing whitey session, accusing the country, claiming that whites apparently represent the number one threat to domestic tranquility, and a lot of projection, because they're accusing, I guess, MAGA supporters, white Americans, are doing the very things that, of course, the Biden administration is guilty of doing, like violating people's civil liberties. And, they're openly calling for censorship. And, of course, it's coming out now through litigation that the Biden administration worked hand in hand with big tech to censor people, which creates a lot of liability for big tech. There could be some large settlements. I like to see that some of these operations bankrupted and liquidated and maybe sold off because they're guilty of violating.
That's right. That's right. No one should have this much power. This is the role of government. Government has to step in and socialize the power of the rich and powerful. And invariably, when you have a new technology, it immediately goes right to oligarchy, monopoly, and so on. Just exactly what happened to the railroads in the 19th century. They were ruthless in their exploitation of the people who had no other way of getting to market. The same thing happened with the new internet technology.
And television and radio, right?
Right. So at a certain point, the government has to step in and start regulating. Well, right now, it's not clear who the government is. Is it Google or is it the people we elect? You know, clearly, I think Google has more power at this point. I'll just give you one example. Whenever someone says, "Yeah, we'd like to have you come here and speak," they'll go to some whatever. I'll give you an example. They go to the Knights of Columbus. Okay. And so I happen to be a Knight of Columbus. This is what is known as a fraternal organization. Okay. You don't have to be a millionaire to join. All you have to do is be a Catholic. Okay. So you go to the head of the Knights of Columbus. The guy says, "I'd like you to invite E. Michael Jones to speak at our council." What is the first thing this man does?
He Googles your name and finds ADL.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. That is exactly what happens. He Googles my name. The first two entries on Google are the ADL and the SBLC.
Okay, so why is a man from Knights of Columbus a good Catholic? Why does he care what have a bunch of Jewish criminals have to say about you?
That's it. Yeah, it's the question. This is a fraternal organization. You're my brother knight here. Yes. And you have to check with the Jew first to see if I'm a Knight of Columbus in good standing? This is outrageous. I'm blaming the Catholics here. I'm blaming the Knights of Columbus. But the main facilitator of this is Google. Who gave Google the right to defame me?
Yeah.
And I have no recourse. This is defamation. That's why they call it the Anti-Defamation League.
Yeah, I was listening to a bit of that United We Stand conference. They had some mayor talking about how the American Council of Mayors is teaming up with private organizations to combat extremism and white supremacy. And the group they're teaming up with is the ADL.
Yeah.
Oh, you have some expert talking about hate crimes. And, of course, his source is the ADL. Again, yeah. Is this some objective and some disinterested, a benign organization? No, it's a Jewish intelligence.
So do we have any recourse in law against this abuse of power? No, the answer is no. This has got to stop. So I just got, before we came on, I just saw that a judge in Texas upheld their anti-deplatforming law. So big tech can technically be prosecuted now for deplatforming. This is because it's censorship. Mm-hmm. So they've completely evaded. They have the power of government with none of the restraints that has been placed on government by things like the Bill of Rights. So the First Amendment doesn't apply here because it's a private entity. Well, who says they're a private entity? I mean, you're the phone company. You're a utility. You have commandeered some new technology, and you mean we're going to let this, we're all going to just sit by helplessly, and government is not going to come to our assistance here to regulate this in the interest of the common good? This is what has to happen here. We have to get back to representative government. We don't have representative government.
Now, you wrote this piece last week regarding the passing of Queen Elizabeth II. Requiem for a Figurehead, and you touch on this topic in the article.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So here, the Queen is dead. Now we have Chucky the Third, Charles the Third. Now,
shame on you for your disrespect here.
And you start the article talking about how the Queen dies, and of course, typically you have these idiots on Twitter come out and start calling her racist and wishing she had an excruciating death, and calling her, of course, a racist and imperialist, all the rhetoric. And this, sparked a reaction by Tucker Carlson. And you say, now we're stuck between two narratives or two sides, either it's critical race theory or Whig history. Now, what is Whig history?
Whig history was a term created by a man named Butterfield. He wrote a book called Whig History. And basically it's talking about how the history of England got taken over by the Whig Party and its scribblers, people like Henry Fielding and Daniel Defoe and people like that, who created a narrative which is basically justifying the usurpation of power in England and the Protestant Reformation, the exclusion of Catholics, the looting of all this type of stuff. It all got marshaled into a narrative which is called Whig history. And it's basically, freedom triumphs in the end, and that justifies all of the bad things that the British monarchy, British Empire did.
So it's progress. So, kind of history is progress.
Yeah. All that type of stuff. And Tucker fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. Now, God bless Tucker Carlson. He's as good as it gets on mainstream media. Mm-hmm. But I'm sorry, Tucker, it was not a benign enterprise. I mean, there's too much DNA in me to allow this thing to pass. My Irish genes and my German genes reacted immediately to this, calling the British Empire benign. Benign is not a word I would use to describe any empire. And I think I have St. Augustine on my side here. St. Augustine said all empires are criminal enterprises. And the only thing that happens over a course of time is they become more and more overtly criminal. As witness, the American empire is run by criminals now. I don't know how else to describe it. The rule of law has gone out the window. It's kind of political prosecution. And that's the situation we're in right now. So the point here is, why are we always being confronted with two equally repugnant alternatives and told to choose one or the other?
Well, yeah, I guess control, you get caught on one of the two sides, and you never really get to address the real problems,
right?
Or the complexity of history.
Right.
You know, something like the British Empire, Western civilization, colonialism in general, is very complex. And these events don't occur in a vacuum. Just as decolonization didn't occur in a vacuum, because what swept in was something arguably, I would say, much more malignant. It was exploited, right. You know, like civil rights movement was exploited by malignant forces.
Right.
Achieving it. Oligarchic end. Basically, it's a front for oligarchy, which is, and just you make the case in the article that as a figurehead, the queen had a responsibility that she didn't live up to protect England from these voracious, rapacious oligarchs that have taken.
Right. Before everybody gets upset at me for saying an awful thing like that the Queen Elizabeth was a figurehead, that's what the word that Boris Johnson used in his eulogy. He said she was a figurehead. And then the next day, King Charles III said that his mother was, he quoted Shakespeare, something like a model for all worldly princes. Well, I agree with Prince Charles. She was the model for all worldly princes because they're all figureheads. That's the problem. That is precisely the problem that we have throughout the world right now. And that's precisely what is causing this reaction. So, you know, in Italy now, as soon as Meloni starts saying she needs to represent Italian interests, Mario Draghi steps in and calls her a fascist. Well, Mario, you used to work for Goldman Sachs. Why don't you bring that up? I think that people like that should wear NASCAR uniforms so we know who's sponsoring them, you know?
Well, yeah, you talk about, of course, the Elizabeth II, of course, the first Elizabeth I. She was the illegitimate daughter, or not, remember, illegitimate. She wasn't the rightful heir to the throne of Henry VIII. And her legitimacy was always in question when she had the Virgin Queen imagery that they created. But this created this sort of, culminated, I guess, in the Civil War the next century. But it brought
because the fundamental issue was legitimacy.
Mm-hmm.
And she had no legitimacy. And the problem was that when you have no legitimacy, you have to use the police state to keep yourself in power, because there was this seething undercurrent of Catholicism during the time of her reign, and she had to repress it brutally. And someone who knew which way the wind was blowing was William Shakespeare. He wasn't as groveling as Edmund Spenser, who wrote The Faerie Queen in honor of this grotesque lady. But he was a Catholic who wanted to get on in this world, and great poetry came out of it. But it was repugnant, because you're caving into someone who has no legitimacy. So the problem after that is legitimacy. And so you have the people who resented the Church of England, thought it was too popish, and that led to the Puritan Revolution. And then you've got even more of a legitimacy problem. Like, what happens when Cromwell dies? Well, you have to bring in one of the Stuarts, and now you've got legitimacy. You restore the thing. But then you come to James II, and you got someone who's a Catholic who's on the throne. Now, he at the beginning had the support of the landed aristocracy because his hereditary credentials were impeccable. He was the legitimate heir. And then he had an heir of himself. And then the idea of Catholic dynasty rears its head. And then they go for the usurper, William of Orange, King Billy the Dutchman, and bring him in. And at this point, they resolve the conflict between the Roundheads and the Puritans. The Cavaliers and the Roundheads. And it becomes a Protestant country.
This is the Glorious Revolution, right?
Yeah, the Glorious Revolution. Right, exactly. But there was still, it wasn't glorious, and it didn't solve the problem. You had a series of Jacobite risings following that, up to the Jacobite rising of 1745, where Bonnie Prince Charlie came within, I think, 60 miles of London with his Scottish Highlanders and their claymores, these big swords that were absolutely deadly in close combat, but not really very effective against cannon. They're hundreds of yards away. And that's why he lost. But the legitimacy thing never went away. Because basically, what did Elizabeth do? She turned it over. I mean, we're talking about literal criminals. We're not talking about anything figurative here. What do you think, Sir Walter Scott? I'm sorry. Sir, who am I confusing him now?
Raleigh.
So, No, no, I'm sorry. Sir Francis Drake.
Francis Drake, yeah, yeah.
Sorry. The pirate.
Yeah.
The pirate who basically looted the Spanish Main, brought back gold, and they knighted him. This, it's like, you know, if you're going to be a thief, don't rob a convenience store. You know, steal the country. It reached the point of parody in when Gilbert and Sullivan did The Pirates of Penzance, where they have that the song where I am a pirate king. You know, this is the dubious background of English monarchy. Mm-hmm. And I think I don't know about you, but I left a week ago to spend some time on the Jersey Shore. I come back and the funeral's still going on. I mean, how long is this thing going to go on? And it strikes me that it's a manifestation of this British insecurity about legitimacy.
Yeah, Queen has going to have almost as many funerals as George Floyd had.
That's and the more power they lose, the more decadent they become, the longer the train of the robe gets. You know what I mean? So it was six guys holding the train. Now we're up to eight, maybe 10 people holding the train when the king is going. We still have to wait for the coronation of Charles III. I mean, mm-hmm. This is going to take forever. What is all this pomp? What is the point of all this pomp? To disguise the problem of legitimacy? Okay, that's an old question, but the figurehead issue still has not been resolved. That's the fundamental question. Who are these people representing? Do the person in charge, the person who has the office, does he represent your interest? Does Merrick Garland represent the interest of the American people?
Well, yeah, I think the question is rhetorical.
It is rhetorical, and the answer is no. And so we have other related issues about, let's say the war in the Ukraine. Another one of those guys of the same tribe is Mr. Blinken. And he represented the United States in negotiations with Russia. Well, it's going to fail. As soon as you get one of these guys in, he starts the conversation by saying he had relatives who died in the Holocaust, and then it's going to go down the drain. You know, even an egomaniac like a megalomaniac like Donald Trump got along well with Putin, and there was no war when he was in office. As soon as the Democrats take power, they send people like this over, and a war is imminent. War happens. Mm-hmm. By the way, just to bring this up, I saw a brilliant analysis. Basically, someone sent me this Rand Corporation document of January of this year, in which the whole rationale for the war came out. This is war on Europe.
Yes,
this is war on Europe. We are trying to destroy Germany now. That is the whole point. And to get to my Queen Elizabeth article, you have this Annalena Baerbock, who is the foreign minister. She's some chick in her 30s. I mean, nothing against chicks in their 30s. I kind of like them. But what experience does she have as in politics? And the Rand Corporation document says the Greens are especially good for this because they have no practical experience in government and they are very ideologically motivated. In other words, they're irrational. So you can't talk to a lady like this. And so she said publicly, we're going to prosecute this war, whether the German voters like it or not. Well, how's that for representative government?
Yeah, so much for self-government, right?
Right.
Yeah. Germany's cutting its own throat. Because Germany's not sovereign for reasons that we've discussed.
No, it is not a sovereign country. And it's been trying, and this is mentioned in the Rand report that say Germany has been slowly but steadily trying to move toward being a sovereign nation. And the classic example of that was the Nord Stream pipelines, which America saw as an existential threat to their hegemony over Europe through NATO.
Yeah, this is very similar to sort of the geopolitical maneuvering in the early part of the 20th century. You know, vis-a-vis Germany and Great Britain, the British
Empire.
It's
the same principle. It's called the Mackinder thesis.
Yeah.
As soon as there's some type of threat for the unification of, say, Germany and Russia, the United States starts a war, or Winston Churchill starts a war. That's why he started World War I.
Yeah. Now, with the get back to, you know, of course, Queen Elizabeth II and her predecessor the first, is that what the English Reformation did, the British Reformation did, was it brought England under the money power, and just did away with any organized resistance or institutional resistance to usury. And also, I think it was, the reintroduction of Jews into Great Britain.
No, not quite. Mm-hmm. There were Jews there. They all had Spanish names or Portuguese names. Mm-hmm. They were not let back in. Until much later.
Yeah, much later. But I guess it was what you have is in the 19th century. You had this debate about, it's called, I guess it was Jewish emancipation in the wake of the Napoleonic Wars, but in Great Britain, you had the repeal of the disability laws, and also the repeal of the Christian oath that you'd have to take to serve in Parliament. I think it was Thomas Macaulay who argued for this, saying that admitting that Jews had a lot of financial power, by bringing them open politically, you'd introduce greater accountability. But in the night, you can speak to this because you write about this in Barren Metal.
Right.
Is the power of usury. So inexorable right. effect of usury has on the country, had it brought England under the thumb of Jewish financial power. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, first of all, Cromwell, the Puritans, were flaming Judaizers. Praise God, Bare Bones was one of these Puritan lunatics who wanted to make Hebrew the official language of England, because that was the language that God spoke in heaven or something like that. But Cromwell didn't let him in. He got a letter from a Puritan who was living in Germany. He said, if you think these are the people of the Old Testament, you're absolutely crazy. You should come to Germany and see the way they have to deal with it. So Cromwell didn't do it, but then Charles I did. As soon as he became to the throne, he let the Jews in. And Manasseh ben Israel was sent over there to negotiate. They froze him out. He didn't even know that they had changed horses in midstream. So the Jews are back in, but the real change didn't take place until the time of the Napoleonic Wars, because at this point, Meyer Amschel Rothschild had sent his son Nathan over to London. And Meyer Amschel had basically the fortune of the Prince of Hesse Castle. He was supposed to keep it for safekeeping, but he sent it over there. And Nathan bet the farm, or the Prince of Hesse Castle's farm, on the consul, which is the bond, the long-term bond, which was always reliable in terms of returns. He bet if Napoleon were going to win, the bond was going to be worthless. So he bet on the bond. He made a killing, and then he started lending money to British aristocrats who wanted to build big houses in the country. And over the course of that period of time, they lost their houses, and they were still in the Almanach de Gotha, which is, Oscar Wilde said, it's the greatest piece of fiction in America, in British literature. And they lost their houses. They retained their title, lost their houses, and all the property fell into the hands of the Jews. So the classic example was Randolph Churchill, who died 60,000 pounds in debt to Natty Rothschild. Instead of just closing the debt or getting the debt from the family, they forgave the debt, but they got Winston Churchill as their pawn, and he became their representative. That led to World War I and so on and so forth. The Balfour Agreement, all of these things. The foot in the door was usury. That's how the Jews got their power in London, and that's how they turned basically the entire aristocracy into figureheads, because they were all beholden to Jewish moneylenders.
And it's one of the driving forces behind the Irish so-called potato famine, because one of the reasons why the British landlords were exporting food from Ireland in the midst of the potato famine, there were alternative sources of food in Ireland, just they're all exported, and the Irish are relegated to the rotten potatoes. It was the pressure of usury, because the payment of interest on loans, correct?
Right. They were all, it's a fundamental principle. It's in Shakespeare's play, Timon of Athens. So you have these aristocrats, they steal the property. Okay, great. You got the property now, but property is not money. Now you can take property, you apply labor to property, and you will get money, but they didn't want that. They're pirates. They're looters. They don't want to work hard labor. So they go to the Jew, they go to the money lender, and they mortgage their land, and eventually they lose the land because they can't keep up with the payments. It's that simple. That's the mechanism. That's how the Jews come into positions of power anywhere where you allow them in and allow them to practice usury.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think the Jewish emancipation occurred in Great Britain in the 1830s when the civil disobedience law or disabilities laws were repealed. Of course, this was the liberal appeal. Britain was becoming more liberal. This is all part of the, parliamentary reforms. And now, within a few decades, you had many Jews espousing Jewish supremacy, serving the parliament. One, of course, was Benjamin Disraeli.
Right.
It was closely linked to Rothschild. It's an interesting story. I was reading, what's that Scottish economist? I forget his name.
Adam Smith.
He's a modern contemporary of ours. A lot of popular economists. Anyway, he wrote a book about the Rothschilds.
Yeah, I read that book. Niall Ferguson.
Niall Ferguson. Yeah, there's an account regarding the Suez Canal purchase where Benjamin Disraeli is maneuvering to take over the Suez Canal. And Parliament's not in session. And so he meets with Lionel Nathan de Rothschild and gets a loan from him to buy the shares from the Khedive of Egypt. It is said that Rothschild said, "What collateral do you offer?" And he says, "I'll offer you the British state."
Yep.
So the British Empire from the mid-19th century on was largely a Rothschild interest. And this is where this is funny because you hear a lot of talk when people talk about the deep state, the British, the role of the British, particularly in getting the nation into World War One or World War Two. You talk about the Round Table, Cecil Rhodes, Milner's Kindergarten, the Boer War, and the British interest in Africa. These were largely Jewish interests driving this.
Yeah.
These were cover for the Beers, the Rothschilds. But my point is, by the late 19th century, early 20th century, what is often British was really financial Jewish interest under the cover of the British. So when people talk about these things, even today, talk about British intelligences, the two were at the very least blended. And I think the tail began to wag the dog a long time ago. This is also true with America. Where financial power, largely Jewish, has now taken over, and it has sort of a British skin to it. So that's why a lot of contemporary or modern analysis of, like, you know, I'm talking about Carol Quigley and some of his analysis in Tragedy and Hope, is we can't mention the ethnic or Jewish component to this because that simply isn't polite nor is it politically correct. It can get you a lot of trouble in some countries. So people feel free to talk about Britain or American Empire when behind that, of course, are Jewish interests. Would you care to comment on that?
Yeah. So the point is, if you leave out the Jewish part of the equation, you'll never understand what's going on. And everything becomes completely isolated, separate events, and there's no connection. And that is part of what they're trying to enforce. I mean, why am I being demonized by the ADL and the SPLC? They are the thought police because I'm making these connections. Am I saying that people should go out and harm the Jew? I've said the exact opposite. It's simply because I am making these connections explicit in books like The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. That broke the taboo. That broke the taboo. That's why I got on their list, because they don't want people talking about this anymore. Well, it's late in the day, and we've reached the point where we cannot not talk about it anymore. I think basically the experience of my last, what I had to go through over the past 10 years since the publication of this book, a little more than 10 years, is that either you're talking about this or you're not in the game anymore. And the main group that is not in the game anymore is the group called conservatives. They have become obsolete. Because everybody knows that they're not talking about the real issues right now. That's the problem. So now the Washington Post did an article on America First. What's conservatism look like without Donald Trump or after Donald Trump? It's called America First. That's true. But now you got all these other people, these opportunists who are coming in and redefining America First. We have to prevent that, because America First It was a historical moment in the 1930s. The main characters were people like Henry Ford, Father Coughlin, and Charles Lindbergh, all of whom were associated with Detroit, which meant they were all associated with manufacturing to some sense or other. Though they're in the middle of the country, it's manufacturing, it's not finance, it's anti-Wall Street. That's what it was. And it's not going to be anything else. That is completely relevant today. That is the issue today. Are we going to get back to manufacturing? Trump did this at the same time. He understood that. He tried to promote the resurgence of American manufacturing while at the same time supporting a pro-Israel foreign policy. And I think his presidency ran aground on that contradiction. I don't know whether he's sadder but wiser now. Did he learn a lesson from the way Benjamin Netanyahu treated him when he needed his help? One of the first guys to recognize Biden as president. Has he learned a lesson? I don't know. These are rhetorical questions.
Yeah, it's something even like a character, a political figure like DeSantis, who's taking on the federal government, the Biden administration with the immigration issue. But he's not really going to the root of the matter with weaponized immigration. This is a Jewish strategy that's been,
right,
be seen in Europe and the United States throughout the Western world to dilute native, ethnic white German whatever populations with a flood of immigrants to create a, create a Tower of Babel which they can reign over. And that's why you see Merrick Garland and Alejandro Mayorkas so dedicated to smearing and declaring white people terrorists, or sorry, they're counter-revolutionaries, because Merrick Garland and Mayorkas, these are latter-day Czechists. So right. when you, as a head of a family, go speak before a school board to condemn critical race theory or transgender education in schools, in the eyes of Mayorkas or Merrick Garland, you are a counter-revolutionary. You're also affecting his bottom line, because his family is actually, this came out last year, is enriching itself, providing curricula for critical race theory.
Yeah.
And so
a little bit of conflict of interest there.
Yeah. So you have a family getting riched off the taxpayer. At the same time, the program is demoralizing and assaulting, the majority population. It's quite a scam, isn't it?
Yeah. So how long is it going to take before people wake up to this? The problem, you're exactly right. DeSantis is in the same bind that Trump is in. So it became critical after Roe versus Wade, where the Jews all announced abortion is a fundamental Jewish value. And Ron DeSantis says that he's got an attorney general who's Jewish, who says he's not going to enforce any of these laws. You have one place after another in this country where you've got a Jew in charge who says he's not going to enforce the law. The fundamental problem with all these Soros prosecutors. And so you have crime rampant, destroying the social fabric, and no one could seem to do anything about this.
Yeah, this speaks to the issue in your article, which other people have written about, is with the Queen. She was the sovereign. She had technically had the power to dissolve Parliament and to veto any act of Parliament. And theoretically, for maybe the Bill of Rights, she had the same powers as Henry VIII. Many people have criticized her for not standing up for England when the time was right. Now, she didn't mind herself dipping her toes into politics, because she pressured Margaret Thatcher to impose sanctions on South Africa in the 80s. And she also pulled the rug out from under Rhodesia in the 1970s. And she was very active in that. So not as if she was aloof from politics when she felt, I guess, passionate about a particular issue. But she did very little. She snubbed Enoch Powell in the 70s. He was worrying about immigration. And the government itself, they have a problem. Here's this lady, Barbara Roche, who's in charge of immigration for Tony Blair. She's Jewish. So why are Jews always in charge of immigration? Anyway, she said her primary concern in politics was fighting anti-Semitism. Well, she's not a British subject. She's not loyal to the crown. She's Jewish. That's what matters most to her. She says it. So she shouldn't be entrusted in that position, because she's going to pursue policies that she thinks benefit Jews set apart from Great Britain.
But and on top of that, they all have an animus against the majority population. Mm-hmm. This is like the Jewish lesbian who's the attorney general in Michigan. You know, she aligns herself with the FBI under Merrick Garland to concoct this plot that someone's going to kidnap the governor.
Yes.
But it's clear she's got two strikes against her. Because she's a Jew, because she's a lesbian, she hates normal people. It's natural. So how can you have people, how can this be possible? Well, I know why. I have an article coming out on why this is possible. It was drug money. It was basically, I know the guy who did it. I interviewed him. He's the guy who's responsible for the decriminalization of marijuana. And he threw his influence and Soros's money. He told me he took Soros's money behind Dana Nessel because he spent his life. He's been a devotee of marijuana legalization for his entire life. He says, you know, the cops don't stop me anymore. They used to stop me all the time because of the drug business. Now they don't stop me anymore. Well, it's not that the attorney general is not going to, she's going to stop prosecuting criminals. That's her job. It's just now she's going to go to the SPLC and find out who the hate speech people are. And they're the people she's going to prosecute.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happens when we're dealing with a fundamental crisis here of the Enlightenment. And it goes all the way back to Napoleon's emancipation of the Jews in France. They were never citizens before that happened. No Christian country would ever consider them citizens because they always represented their own interests and not the interests of the people they lived among. That's been the problem. That problem has not gone away. It's only gotten worse. So it goes, we now have this crisis revolving around this concept of equality, which is one of the fundamental principles of the French Revolution and principle of the modern state. And it's led to God knows what, you know, now transgendered. You're supposed to allow people, doctors to mutilate children in the interest of equality or something like that. It's become totally bizarre. But we have to face up to this fact. Can this group of people is it possible for them to serve in government without distorting the policies and pursuing policies that are inimical to the interest of the majority? That's a fundamental question we have to ask now because of all of the bad experience we've had and all of these people who are serving in government who have dual citizenship with Israel. Would that be a place to start? Is someone going to take that on? No one with dual citizenship is allowed to serve in the government. Wouldn't that be a step in the right direction?
It would have a disparate impact on a certain very powerful oppressed ethnic group. They're oppressed and powerful. I don't understand how that works.
I don't either, but it seems to work well for them.
Yeah, then they can do things like they have like black proxies, like Merrick Garland installs Kristen Clark at the Department of Justice Office of Civil Rights Enforcement, or division, what they call it. And she's an avowed black supremacist. She's actually believes that blacks are superior, smarter, and more peaceful
right.
than the white counterparts. And just this person is in charge of enforcing civil rights. But then again, I heard Merrick Garland talk about the Justice Department was created to defend black people from white people. And white people are evil in his estimation.
Who knew? It was. It's probably in one of those amendments. It's probably in the Constitution somewhere, but no one figured it out up until this
point. Yeah. Now, I'm looking at the crime statistics. I'm seeing something completely opposite of that, but that's all.
Yeah, but that's because you're a white guy. You know, you can't help yourself. But the other point is that it's never simply Jewish interest. You know, they always have some type of crusade and creation of proxy warriors.
Well, there was someone who read, I think I was reading, Kerry Bolton. He has a book called The Tyranny of Human Rights. He says that human rights were discovered in South Africa the moment they found gold and diamonds.
Yeah.
So it's exploited. Yeah. These divisions.
Or like the civil rights movement.
Yes. Yeah.
Was a classic example of the Jews using blacks as their proxy warriors. You know, Brown versus School Board was based on Jewish science. And Murray Freeman is a guy who said this, and he's bragging about it. He was the head of the AJC, the American Jewish Committee in Philadelphia. And that's where when our great Archbishop Chaput was talking about school prayer, and he said it was done by secularizing activists, wrote that article in First Things. No, it was the American Jewish Committee. It was Leo Pfeffer. It was Milton Schaap. It was all of these people. And to say that you don't know that means you're never going to get to the root of the problem here. We have to start connecting these dots, and we have to start making decisions along these lines. One of the decisions is going to be in Pennsylvania, because you got Josh Shapiro running against a man who has a vowel at the end of his name. So he's Italian, presumably Catholic, a Republican, certainly.
Didn't he endorse Christian nationalism or something? Am I mistaking that? I thought
Andrew Torba has written a book called Christian.
Yeah, I think he talked about that book or something. I might be mistaken. So
he mentioned Christian nationalism, and then he has supported Mastriano.
Okay, that's what it is. Okay, yeah.
In the case, so I think we have people in Pennsylvania have a clear choice, and certainly there are never enough Jews.
Well, when you have a Jewish governor close churches, does that get your attention? I'm just saying. No. Or Pritzker in Illinois, where they're calling it the Purge Law, the Safety Act, where they're pretty much doing with all cash bail, and sort of giving criminals the free run of the state.
Yeah, the Jews are getting heavily involved in this type of thing. And so you get this increasing criminality. So you got a clear Josh Shapiro went after the Catholic Church. He brags about it in his campaign literature. He took on the most powerful institution in the world. You mean the IPAC? No. He meant the Catholic Church.
He didn't release like 400 names of accusations without any.
No, I think it was 300 names. It's a grand jury. A grand jury is fact finding commission.
Yeah.
Okay. So he found enough material there to bring out one indictment, but he released the names of 300 priests. Well, that's unconscionable. What you're saying is you have absolutely no reason to prosecute these people. So why are you blackening their name by releasing it? And he's running on this. Yeah. So any Catholic who votes for Josh Shapiro has got to be crazy.
Isn't a Jewish gal that leaked the Supreme Court? They suspected there's no investigation.
Yeah, that's right. It was
one abortion.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot her name now. It was a blip. But she did that with impunity. No one ever got prosecuted for releasing the Alito's statement.
Mm-hmm.
So that was that. Now, I just said any Catholic would have to be crazy to vote for Josh Shapiro. But then, you know, I just went back to Philadelphia. I went back to where I went to high school, and we were talking about how all of these Catholic girls' schools were run by nuns, and the nuns all became feminists, and they taught feminism in these schools. And if you teach feminism, chances are the young girls are going to end up getting sexually active, and then they're going to have abortions. And once they've had abortion, they vote like Jews. That's the whole point. That's why Ruth Bader Ginsburg was so adamant about imposing abortion on the entire country. That is how they have their power. That is where their power comes from. It's the sexual corruption of the majority. You get them involved in horrible sins like killing your own child, and then you create a movement around it called feminism, which ensures that they will never repent for the sins that they've committed. And you got, that's the backbone. I don't think this is an exaggeration. I think that's the backbone of the Democratic Party right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. At the same time, you can do nothing to protect the public from pornography or sexual corruption, because that's the First Amendment. But political speech is strictly limited, hate speech laws and these things. And that's one thing that you talk about in your article, Queen Elizabeth I, is the Twitter, social media, constant pornographic imagery comes up. And there's nothing, apparently no sovereign can step in and stop this.
No.
And she was a sovereign, but she apparently either didn't want to exercise the power to act like as a sovereign to protect her country, protect the heritage, the patron.
She was the head of the Church of England at this time. And that's what I said. What did she do to prevent the moral decline that followed from the corruption of the Church of England? When you prevented the unification with the Catholic Church, which was likely to happen after Vatican II, when you allowed homosexuals to become bishops, when you allowed this type of degradation to spread through the church, and she did nothing to oppose it. Nothing, nothing. So why are we lionizing a woman who, where she could, I think she could have had some effect with the church. And the effect that she had was to promote decadence, and it return to bite her through her family, her children.
Yeah, her family's corrupted by it, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, you heard stories about Margaret in the 60s and the wild parties and swinging London and all that. And
then we had that situation with Andrew and Jeffrey Epstein.
Well, that's, yeah, Epstein, there, and there's a Jewish, another Jewish connection. yeah,
pure,
I guess
coincidence, that, just coincidence, yeah. Just coincidence. had yeah. nothing to do with his behavior.
Yeah, well, like I said, there's someone that said that, you know, with the queen, what's her job as a sovereign queen is, well, the monarch, they have some sense of, they may, their time horizons may be different. They have some sense of, I guess, they have a sort of a proprietorship view of the country, theoretically. And whereas in a democracy, you're bound to get some scheming politician who wants to get rich in a few years.
Yeah.
The monarchy, this is the event, and she didn't live up to that. She could have been a martyr for a greater cause, whether her supposed Christian faith or
for just her people, for the Christian people of England.
Yeah.
So I'm saying the rule of British ceremony is the number of uniforms is in direct proportion to the rise of decadence. The more the decadence spread throughout the culture, the more you have to have hundreds of soldiers in all those exotic uniforms marching around in perfect synchronized step to disguise the fact that she did nothing to stem the decay of morals, which was her job. The job was to prevent this at the very least because of her position as head of the Church of England. Yeah, she did nothing.
But that's what the crown is for.
So you don't have any control over foreign policy. Okay, but you did have control over the Church of England, and you did nothing to stem the tide of decadence. And try now we're going to cover it over because we're going to have 500 soldiers with bearskin caps marching in your funeral to distract us from the fact that you did nothing to protect your own people.
And I guess England is another example, the proof that if a country is alienated from its Christian faith, that it's a country that's soon to die and be taken over.
Or that's exactly what Civiltà Cattolica said. Mm-hmm. They said it with regard to France. If a country turns away from Christian rulers and Christian laws, it will be ruled by Jews. Well, if there's ever proof of that, it's England, much more so than France.
Yes. Well, I said I have you for an hour, so I don't want to cheat. The article is Requiem for a Figurehead. It was in the UNS Review. Anything else you want to tell us about? Be coming up?
Yes, lots coming up. Dangers of Beauty is available now. I just gave mm-hmm. two real great talks. I mean, great audiences in both Philadelphia and West Virginia. So
can you watch those?
There's an audio.
Oh, it's an audio. Okay. You'll be posting
an audio. It will be posted tomorrow.
Okay, great.
So you can go to culturewars.com, buy the book, listen to the audio, and, anyway, thanks for having me. It was a great discussion once again.
Thank you for coming back on the show. I'll let you enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thank you.
Good night, then. Bye-bye.
Good night.
The stories have been told of kings in days of old, but there's no England now. All the wars that were won or lost somehow don't seem to matter very much anymore. All the lies we were told, all the lives of the people running round their castles are burned. Oh, I see change, but inside we're the same as we ever were. Living on a thin line. Ooh. Right their hearts and breaks their heads. Is there love?